странах Балтии военную угрозу
явной
Москвы
угрозе
реально.
Странам Балтии, исходящим
от масштабные военные учения сил Северного флота,
военных 65 военных кораблей.
Тактический комплекс «Искандер-М».
Обороны Литвы и Эстонии выразили
обеспокоенность. Литвы Далия Грибаускайте это назвала
российская
Россию.
Армия стала невероятно мобильная.
И ответный удар нанести, а может быть и превентивный.
Bellicose rhetoric, menacing overflights, air and sea space violations, cyber attacks, border incursions, and abductions. For the past year, Russia's been turning up the heat on the Baltic states with alarming military provocations on their frontiers and persistent attempts to agitate their Russian minorities. For more than four decades, Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians lived under Soviet occupation. And when they all joined NATO 11 years ago, it appeared they were finally, once and for all, free from the hand of Moscow. But are they? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is veteran Kremlin watcher Edward Lucas, director of the Baltic Sea Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis and author of the books The New Cold War and Deception, Spies, Lies, and How Russia Dupes the West. Welcome back, Edward. Glad you could join us.
Nice to be on the show.
Nice to have you. And joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. is political analyst Angia Grigas, author of the forthcoming book, Rebuilding the Russian Empire. Welcome, Agnia.
Pleasure to be here.
And also a pleasure to have you. And also joining us from Tartu, Estonia, is Vjelo Petai, director of the Institute of Government and Politics at the University of Tartu and co-author of the book Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. Welcome to the podcast, Vjelo.
Hello, Brian.
Hello. Good to see you after all these years. About a year ago, I was at a NATO event in Brussels, and I had a really interesting conversation about the Russian threat to the Baltics with some young Estonian journalists. These guys were looked to be in their 20s or so. At one point, one of them just shrugged and said, "Well, if the worst happens and Russia invades, we'll just have to go to the forest again. Our grandparents did it, and so could we." And I thought, man, that is so Estonian, you know, unflappable, almost to a fault. Let's start with you, Vjelo, since you're basically at ground zero of this thing, so to speak. How are Estonians really responding to all this? Is there fear, resolve, resignation? What are you seeing there?
Well, I can certainly corroborate that aspect of black humor that Estonians sometimes express when they deal with Russia and they think about Russia. There's never really a full sense of security, and so you're always worried about what might come next. But in relation to the concrete sort of moment, I think that yes, Estonians are less sanguine about what's going on east of the border. There are a lot of concrete steps that have been taken, and most of all in terms of building our relations with allies within NATO, within the European Union, and even more broadly. And a lot of those have very concrete manifestations in terms of closer military cooperation, closer political cooperation. And I think a lot of those things are giving Estonians a little bit more comfort over the last months and weeks even, but we'll have to see what Russia does in the broader scope of things. I mean, it's not just here in the Baltics, it's in Ukraine itself, of course, and in other regions of the former Soviet Union. So we're working, we're trying to keep a level head, and in particular, together with the allies, that's exactly why Estonia went west, was to embed itself in these ties, in these allies and these connections. And now I think it's time to make use of those connections.
Do people feel that the allies are doing enough at this point? I know, especially since the Wales summit, NATO is kind of beefing up its presence in the Baltic states. Do people feel that's enough?
Well, I think they certainly feel the presence because it's spoken about quite a lot across all three of the Baltic states. I mean, there's what is essentially permanent presence of Allied troops in all three of the countries, be it through the Air Force, be it through infantry, constant exercises going on. All of this is meant as a kind of deterrent signal to Russia and also to build up sort of relations within NATO that the Baltic states are part of NATO. And this is a big difference from what it was, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago, when it became clear that NATO actually had no forward plans for the Baltic states, because it was just some sense that nothing would happen here. But now we're definitely in all of the military plans, all the other kinds of strategic and tactical activities of NATO, and that is felt here.
Mm-hmm. Now, Agnia, in your last book, and I'm really looking forward to your new one, by the way, but in your last book, The Politics of Energy and Money Between the Baltic States and Russia, you looked at the different ways the Balts have approached Russia since independence. How do you assess all three countries' reactions to Moscow's bellicose posture now? Are you seeing the same differences you wrote about in your first book?
Well, first of all three Baltic states are concerned today, but they have, I would say, taken somewhat different approaches to the current aggression and, hard rhetoric coming out of Russia. So Estonia and Latvia have focused, I would say, a bit more on addressing Russia's information warfare. They've stated, both Estonia and Latvia, they stated that they will create a joint, they would jointly develop a Russian language TV. So that's a very important program because, first they have a large Russian-speaking populations in the country, and they want to provide an alternative view just outside of Russia's state-controlled mm-hmm. media. So that's a big focus. Lithuania, likewise, in that area had restricted Russian TV channels for 3 months after some particularly aggressive programs were aired on Russian TV. Estonia also has a cybersecurity center, so that's one area that the NATO Center of Excellence on cybersecurity. So that's one area the region continues to work on. But in Lithuania, what's interesting, I think I've seen more a response in the maybe traditional military sphere. I mean, Lithuania recently issued conscription again, mm-hmm. and that was a big move. So the goal is to call up annually about 3,000 men. So that's something different that Lithuania is doing rather than Estonia or Latvia. Although likewise in Estonia, we've seen a lot more volunteers. Right now there are around 15,000 volunteers joining various civic military organizations or organizations like the Estonian Defense League. And overall, this internal security agencies of all three states have been more active over the last year in particular.
Uh-huh. Now, there has always been a degree of Baltic unity, but it's not been absolute. Do you see Russia's actions now increasing Baltic unity? Or are we seeing more of it?
I think there are efforts to coordinate, and there have always been efforts to coordinate policies, let's say, across the Baltic states. But I think also the Baltic states are always looking towards their allies in the West. So I think there's maybe more of an effort to get greater involvement from NATO and greater attention from the EU. I think the Baltic states would do well to coordinate more even in this area. I mean, I've mentioned Latvia and Estonia are coordinating in the sphere of information warfare, but I think that would be an area where they could do more together, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to, joint forces and military responses. But I'm open to fielding that question to someone else.
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll get into this as we get into the discussion. Edward, last time you were on the podcast, you noted, and these are your exact words I'm quoting, I checked, what used to be the crackpot Edward Lucas opinion that Russia is a threat to Europe has now become mainstream. I must say I agree with you, except the crackpot bit, of course. You were onto this long before a lot of others. So I want to draw out your latest crackpot opinion that'll probably be mainstream next week. What is Russia up to here in the Baltics? What is the objective of all of this? Is it just to intimidate, or is there something worse? And if the worst case scenario happens, how do you see NATO in the West responding?
I think it's important to realize that just as with Ukraine, it's not really about Ukraine. In the Baltics, it's not really about the Baltics. These are both symptoms of Western weakness and Russia's belief that it can overturn the European Security Order. The Baltics are extremely important from a Western point of view because they're members of NATO and the EU. They're also very difficult to defend in narrow military terms. They're rather like West Berlin during the Cold War, symbolically vital, but militarily indefensible. And so if this is the one place in Europe where NATO could be over by breakfast, if we had a sharp provocation, perhaps a real military attack, maybe something else, where the Balts appeal for Article 5 support from NATO and don't get it, because maybe President Obama says he wants to have to talk to Putin first before invoking full NATO response, then NATO's over by breakfast. And I think Putin knows that, and that makes the Baltics extremely important. There's a very serious problem about the military configuration in the Baltics, that we can't make the Baltic states secure except by doing things that make Kaliningrad indefensible. And Putin, Russia, can't make Kaliningrad defensible without doing things that make the Baltic states extremely vulnerable. So once trust disappears, which it has, there's a real danger of quite a rapid regional escalation, I think.
Mm. Now, Vilo and Agni, I'd like you to weigh on this. I mean, are there fears that one of the Baltic states or all of the Baltic states may ask for Article 5 protection and it won't be granted? Are people worried about that? Are they talking about that? Because this is a real, real issue. Again, when I was in speaking to a NATO general about this, and I said, what is an Article 5 an Article 5 violation, for example? If Russia sends little green men and claims they're not its little green men to Narva, is that an Article 5 violation? Is a cyber attack an Article 5? Is seizing an Estonian police officer, which is something we'll talk about in the second half of the program, on Estonian territory, an Article 5 violation? Where is the threshold? And the general could not answer my question. He really couldn't. Are there concerns in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania that something might happen and an Article 5 is not invoked?
Actually, the question has been on the agenda for more than a year, I think, because everyone knows that this article is out there, and it's quite obvious that we need to think about whether it works or not and in what way it works. But I think that we have to get away from this kind of binary understanding of a single tripwire and actually see it in a more modulated form. And that's exactly what I think the Baltic states have also been doing over the last year. Namely, they've been pushing for pre-deployment of forces, pre-deployment of materiel, and a beefing up of a lot of infrastructural capacity for these defense forces that will then allow for not only quick deployment in case Article 5 needs to be called upon, but also to have that even day-to-day presence. I mean, what we literally see happening are the military exercises being organized for, let's say, 4 weeks, and then they end on a Friday, and what do you know? Another set of four-week exercises is declared for the next Monday. So, you know, it's not called permanent deployment, but it is actually a series of continuing, cascading, if you will, kind of activities, and that helps to mix up the picture a little bit, and I think that's what we need to do in this given situation.
Now, Agnia, you indicated you had something to say about this. What are your thoughts on this Article 5 issue and the fears that may or may not be there?
Yeah. Well, I think there are certainly valid concerns that Russia will try to destabilize the Baltic states, but it will try to do so below the threshold level. So it will rely on various, you know, covert activities, efforts to maybe create riots as they had done in Estonia in 2007, potentially little green men and etc. But I think it's interesting also to remember that, you know, before Article 5, there's Article 4. And mm-hmm. with Article 4, countries can call for consultations. And in fact, Poland has already invoked Article 4 recently for consultations with the allies for the region. So I think certainly NATO is watching the situation very carefully, and the allies are already in consultations considering what they can do to strengthen the region. And here in Washington, D.C., Secretary General of NATO Jens Stoltenberg has stated very clearly that NATO's response will be commensurate to whatever Russia's policies are. So if cyber warfare will be engaged, NATO will consider how to address cyber warfare. If it's little green men, they will consider how to address little green men. And so forth.
Right. So, now, Velo raises a really interesting point here, and I want to go to you, Edward. Go ahead, Edward, because there's something.
Well, I think that it's all happening too slowly. Yeah, I'm glad that NATO is beginning to think about military reinforcement of the Baltic states. They've started doing exercises. There are the beginnings of NATO information warfare. NATO is beginning to think about all these things. But it's all, I think, too little and too late at the moment. I think that Article 4 was a very important symbolic step, and unfortunately Poland took it over Ukraine, and it no longer has any symbolic weight. I think that we've lost Article 4 without even realising that we had it, because nothing happened when Poland asked for Article 4. And so I'm also very worried about the failure to include Sweden and Finland, because from a military point of view, you can't really do anything militarily in the Baltic states without Sweden and Finland involved. Although opinion there is shifting towards NATO membership in both countries, it's not going to happen overnight. It's far from being a done deal. And we could have a sharp security crisis this fall in the Baltic states. And my worry is that I don't think at the moment either NATO or the Baltic states or the other countries in the region or the United States or the big European powers are really ready to deal with that.
Agnia Vielo, any thoughts on that?
Well, and I would say part of the problem here is the fact that there hasn't been sufficient interest and attention on these issues over the last decade even. So, yes, I think NATO and even the Baltic states themselves have been maybe somewhat scrambling to address the situation over the last year. But this is really something that should have been, thought deeply and thoughtfully about over the last decade, when in fact over the last decade there had been increasing signs, as well, Edward Lucas has worked on this a lot, there's been increasing signs that Russia is getting increasingly aggressive, increasingly revisionist, and trying to address this gradually over the years.
And it may or may not be too little too late, as you say, Edward, but I wanted to raise something that Vielo raised, because I think this is a really important point, is that by creating this tripwire, i.e. having this troop presence on the border there, it changes the equation a little bit, because it's not, well, if Putin does something in the Baltics, are we going to invoke Article 5? Before he does something in the Baltics, there's already going to be NATO troops there. Do you think that changes the equation at all?
It changed the equation, but not in a math paper that we're trying to deal with, I think. It's if Putin is not stupid, and he's not going to give us the kind of clear, convenient ultimatum that would make that tripwire relevant. I think I may be proved wrong, that he's going to say within 4 weeks, I want a corridor to Kaliningrad or equal political and language rights for the Russian speakers in Estonia and Latvia. And if I don't get it, I'm going to invade. The clock starts now. Because that indeed would be the sort of thing that we can respond to. It's much more likely we get this kind of ambiguous, messy threat involving little green men, possibly described disguised as bikers or football or sports fans or something. It's going to be accompanied with an absolute blizzard of propaganda and possibly economic sanctions and cyber attacks and so on. And it will be very confusing when it comes, as I fear it will. And I don't think having a company of US soldiers in each of the three Baltic states is going to give us the situational awareness to spot what's happening or the means to respond to it at the moment. I don't want to sound too gloomy, because I do think things are moving in the right direction. But the main message I have is we've got to accelerate what we're doing, accelerate it fast.
Oh, and you've certainly been right in the past. I guess my calculation is that if the little green men come, whether they're in the form of bikers or sports fans, they're going to bump into NATO troops pretty quickly. No,
do you imagine that a company of American troops is going to be able to open fire on a bunch of Russian bikers without very, very high level political authorization? And by the time they get it, it'll be too late.
Yeah. Okay, well,
yes, and also,
go ahead.
Well, if we consider what happened in 2007 in Tallinn, the riots involving a lot of Russian-speaking youth, Russian minorities, again, this is the type of situation where, well, would NATO troops would really go in and try to engage Russian teenagers rioting in the streets? I mean, I think it would be a very, very difficult situation.
But I mean, I would definitely say that that's on the radar scope in terms of understanding what the threats are and remembering very well what the situation was here during the 2007 riots. Then partly that particular incident was sort of self-inflicted at the time, but at the same time it was very much whipped into something much bigger than it was at the time at the moment. But I think that those things could be orchestrated indeed. In particular, northeast Estonia, which would then provide territorial proximity to then perhaps offer or demand some kind of Russian peacekeeping troops to be then deployed either in northeast Estonia or in eastern Latvia as well. And those things have to be taken seriously, and they have to be examined by the relevant Estonian, Latvian, maybe even Lithuanian authorities in the given instance, and sort of be monitored. I don't think that they will come entirely out of the blue. I think that the relevant security services in each of the countries is working on those issues, but by absolutely, I agree that is probably the modus vivendi that would be chosen, apart from the sort of coming across the border with a bunch of tanks.
Let's pick up on this issue with the Russian minorities, because it certainly is something I wanted to talk about. It's something all of us have a little bit experience reporting on or doing research on. I mean, one of the big lessons, and I've written this on the blog, said it on the podcast. One of the big lessons of the Ukraine crisis was that ethnicity and language don't always necessarily equal political loyalty. Ukraine's Russian speakers and ethnic Russians in places like Odessa and Dnipropetrovsk surprised a lot of people. Vilo, will the Russians of Narva surprise us?
Well, I think that to a certain degree they have already, in the sense that we even had a major military demonstration there in February, a parade, including American troops marching through, and they were more than happily welcomed and indeed observed in Narva, barely 500 meters from the Russian border. So in many ways, I don't see that threat coming in a direct sense. Picking up what Agnė mentioned earlier, it is true that Estonia and Latvia have worked more harder now on thinking about what kind of how to respond to the information war and to generate Russian language national television programs that would produce programming that would inform but also provide entertainment. I think everyone here is realistic enough to understand that it's not possible to create mega television stations that would completely shut out or block or deter people from watching Russian Federation television. But nonetheless, there is an attempt at least to do a more proactive information policy, but it will be slow in the making. I mean, it's only now that they're putting together producers and thinking up different types of programming, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that is going as fast as it can. I think what in the Estonian case I'm a little bit disappointed is that there is less of a thought to returning to Estonia's actual integration program that it had up until 2007. It was pretty unceremoniously discontinued after that, the Bronze Soldier incident, and it really hasn't picked up speed since then. So it would be nice to have a rethink about where we're going with language training, with educational reform, and a lot of other things in a more coherent and systematic manner. But the current government decided to nix that option.
Agnė, how do you see, I know that you addressed this in your new book. You're looking at this very issue in your new book. How do you see it?
Well, for my forthcoming book, I interviewed a lot of young Russians and Russian speakers across the post-Soviet space and in the Baltic states. And for one, I saw a huge generational divide between the youth and the older generation. And the youth today are much more likely to be integrated into the local society, to identify themselves as, say, Estonians or Latvians. But, that said, Russia has worked very hard to try to co-opt these people, to woo them, and really, in the end, to passportize them, to give them out Russian citizenship. So I think this is a great concern. I mean, and this is when we talk about Narva. For me, the greatest concern is that in the small city of Narva, 30% of the population has Russian passports. And that's a huge concern, because really when Russia starts talking about protecting its compatriots, it starts talking about protecting, you know, Russians or Russian citizens and compatriots abroad. So I think the Baltic states also have to be very engaged in also wooing and kind of winning the hearts and minds of their minorities. And this is not only Latvia and Estonia. I think there's too often the belief that because Latvia and Estonia have larger minorities, therefore, you know, they have to do more work or they're more at risk. But also Lithuania, though it has a rather small Russian minority, under 6%, I think they have been insufficiently focused on this issue area. And they likewise have to do more to integrate them, to engage them, to run various programs, especially for the youth, for the Russian-speaking youth.
Edward, how do you see the ethnic Russian language issue? Is this weapon overrated?
I think we should be very careful, first of all, about not using Kremlin terminology and being sort of dragged into that frame of reference, that the whole idea of a Russian minority or talking about Russians or compatriots is, to me, much too precise and crude a term. You've got all sorts. You have people who speak, as in Ukraine, you have people who speak Russian at work and the local language at home, or vice versa. You have people of mixed parentage, mixed marriages. You have people who may be ethnically Russian but politically very strongly aligned with the local country, and indeed vice versa. I've met Lithuanians who are in London who are Lithuanians and are also very strong Putinists and turn up to my meetings here and berate me for being pro-Western. Yeah, so I think I think in terms of integration, what's clear from the research is that if you have really good command of written Estonian, to take the Estonian example, then you function in Estonian society just as if ethnicity becomes irrelevant. So command of language is an extremely important issue, and I would echo Velo's point that I think that it's a pity to downplay integration policy. It's a slow and sometimes thankless task, but if you want to create an Estonian or Latvian idea of a polis and a demos that is different from the whatever ethnos people think they come from, then that doesn't come just by chance. I think it needs work. But I actually think I'm less worried about Russia making mischief on this sort of purely ethnic and linguistic front. I think they can exploit regional tensions. We've seen in eastern Latvia a certain amount of work claiming that the Latgali region of eastern Latvia is disadvantaged. We see extraordinary Russian connections with the soi-disant Polish Polish-speaking minority in Lithuania, where the leader of that wears a St. George's ribbon and is in alliance with the local Russians. But I actually think the single most dangerous thing is the transit to Kaliningrad. I think that's something that in this paranoid Putinist mindset that the Russians increasingly adopt, they see Kaliningrad as a trophy of their victory in World War II, somehow sacred. They think it's endangered. The West is trying to cut it off. And that they've talked themselves into feeling that this is really very vulnerable and they need to do something really decisive to make sure that they hang on to Kaliningrad, the West doesn't take it. Now, I think they're deluded in thinking we want to do that, but it doesn't make it any less dangerous.
Okay, well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and zero in on the case of an Estonian law enforcement officer who was abducted in Estonia, taken to Russia, and charged with espionage. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is veteran Kremlin watcher Edward Lucas, director of the Baltic Sea Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis and author of the books The New Cold War and Deception, Spies, Lies, and How Russia Dupes the West. Also joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. is political analyst Agnija Grigas, author of the forthcoming book Rebuilding the Russian Empire. And joining us from Tartu, Estonia, is Vjelo Petai, director of the Institute of Government and Politics at the University of Tartu and co-author of the book Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Эстон Кохлер, сотрудником
ВДВ. Начнется рассмотрение дела Эстона Кохлера.
При обыске у Эстона Кохлера обнаружили спецтехнику для...
контрабанде и незаконном пересечении границы.
Стражи Кохлера Эстона продлили до 4 августа. Проявляется кадровым офицером, который дал...
As I wrote in the blog this week, not long ago, Эстон Кохлер was an Estonian law enforcement officer investigating a suspected smuggling operation by organized crime groups. Today, he is a potent symbol of Russia's challenge to the international order. And by now, we all know the details, but for the benefit of those who don't, on the morning of September 5th, 2014, Kochver was on his way to meet a confidential informant in a secluded forest just kilometers from the Russian border. In what Estonian officials describe as a well-planned operation, he was ambushed with stun grenades, abducted at gunpoint, taken across the border with Russia, and charged with espionage. His trial is scheduled to begin Monday in Pskov Oblast, and he faces more than two decades in prison. I've been giving Eston Kochver case a lot of attention this week. I did a Daily Vertical video on it, I wrote a blog on it, and I'm dedicating half of this podcast to it for a good reason. I think it's damn important. Russia sees an EU citizen from the territory of an EU country. I think that really needs to sink in, and there's nothing anybody, it seems to be, there's nothing anybody can do about it. Vjelo, how is this playing in Estonia? How are people reacting to this? Are preventive measures being taken to prevent similar incidents in the future? Can similar incidents in the future be prevented unless Estonian citizens just avoid their own border, for God's sakes? Give me the lay of the land there on this.
Well, the first measure that was certainly taken was indeed to clean the border, and in quite a literal sense, namely that all kinds of bulldozers and perhaps even machete knives and others were pressed into service in order to really clean up all of the sort of wooded areas that actually constitute the border and that have never really been touched over the last 20 years, simply because Estonia has yet to conclude a formal border treaty with Russia, and as a result of a certain amount of dispute over where the border should be drawn, because the Russian Federation shifted the border in 1944, and the Estonians have never been quite sure that that was the right thing to do. The point simply being that indeed dozens of kilometers of this territory were a little bit of a no man's land, and that clearly facilitated the KGB's or FSB's possibilities to do what it did. And so there has been a lot of work done to really clear an open path and that can be more clearly monitored and surveyed. But beyond that, I think that Estonians were very shocked when this happened. There was a lot of discomfort, needless to say, at what this means to have your own citizen be abducted in such a manner. And I think by now it's kind of, for lack of a better word, sort of settled down in the sense that, of course, the Estonian media and observers pay attention to for better or for worse, to the farce that is going on in terms of the legal proceedings that have been going on in Moscow and now in Pskov for Kochver. But I think that behind the scenes, there's a lot of effort to work with allies and to find other solutions. I think we all know that in the end of the day, these kinds of incidents are resolved through oftentimes exchanges and other political deals that are struck. And so that's why a lot in the public realm, everything is hush-hush. We'll have to see what other elements will come into play over time in order to bring a resolution to this issue. But at the moment, it's pretty much stalemate, or at least the windmills, the mills of the justice system in Russia are just grinding their own path forward, and hopefully things are also happening at other levels.
In terms of a deal being made, one has to wonder, isn't that kind of like negotiating with terrorists? I mean, won't it just encourage this kind of behavior in the future? I guess, Edward, what do you think? Is there anything the West can do here, or Estonia? How do you respond to something? Because everybody seems powerless in this guy who is doing his job is now in the middle of a show trial in Russia.
Yeah. And I think it's a bit like MH17. It's, something that happens that's absolutely outrageous. It breaks every, principle of good neighborliness and international law, and the West is gravely concerned, and And I think the Estonians are quite right to question how strong their allies' intention to defend them really is. This happened just hours after President Obama had been in Tallinn, saying an attack on one is an attack on all. I think I would have liked to have seen, for example, the coordinated expulsion of Russian intelligence officers from the embassies and consulates all over Europe. I'd have liked to have seen a break in cooperation with the Russian FSB, so we just don't have relations with that anymore. And I would like to see a much tougher attitude generally on Russian organized crime in the West. But we didn't do that. And I think that as often happens with these things, Russia does something, it gauges the reaction, it sees there isn't much reaction, it learns its lesson from that. And I feel very ashamed as a member of another NATO country that we didn't do more to help Estonia on this.
Agnia, your thoughts?
Well, I viewed that incident as a direct challenge to Estonia and to the Estonian state. And for me, I see parallels also in what happened in Lithuania recently. I mean, essentially when the Russian government reopened 25-year-old cases against Lithuanian men who had not served in the Soviet army. So right now, there's about 1,500 Lithuanian men that could be arrested if they travel to Russia or potentially outside of NATO countries. And this is a similar type of challenge to, you know, almost was the statehood of Lithuania by saying that, these Lithuanian men now will be subject to Russia's laws.
To the Soviet Union's laws.
To the Soviet Union's laws, exactly. To the laws of a state that hasn't existed in 25 years. That, in a way, almost challenges Lithuania's independence and the last 25 years. So for me, this is a type of similar approach on the Russian side to try to test the limits of Baltic almost independence. And
now, Agnia, I'm very glad you brought that up because I had meant to include that. It's at some point in here, and you did my job for me. So thank you. Now, I wrote on my blog this week about that this case, this Kochver case, really is. It's symbolic of all the things Russia's been doing over the last year. It's symbolic of its challenge to the international order. I mean, it illustrates how they use organized crime groups abroad. It illustrates how they completely flawed international law. And it's symbolic of the disinformation campaign. They constructed this absurd counter narrative, which is countered by a protocol co-signed by their own border guards. Right. I mean, really, I mean, it's worse than MH17 in the sense that no official Russian ever signed on to what everybody knows is what really happened to MH17. In this case, on the day of the incident, Russian border guards signed a joint protocol in two languages with Estonian border guards about what happened there. So this is something that's very symbolic. But what do you think Russia was trying to accomplish here? Was it just testing, or it's been suggested that Kochver was indeed investigating a smuggling ring? There's been allegations that the FSB was involved with Russian organized crime groups in that part of Estonia, and it was involved in smuggling. That this was a message from the FSB to the Estonian Internal Security Service, like don't mess in this territory. What do you think was going on here? I guess anybody weigh in on this. I don't have a guess. Velo, go ahead.
Well, I think that at least the story that's of course given here is that the FSB operation was probably extravagant or at least extensive enough that it couldn't have been mounted just simply in 48 hours following the departure of President Obama in early September. But so that, gives credence to the fact that this was somehow thought up before. Of course, we all knew that Obama was coming also.
And we knew the NATO summit was. And we knew the NATO summit was going to be at that time.
We knew a lot of things in advance. So, how are we going to connect the dots? That's definitely something that indeed the security people are doing. I don't know. I think on some level, this reminds one of what happens in North Korea. You know, people are then abducted in North Korea, foreigners, be they Korean Americans or other people who try to show up there. And then they're kept there. And then, of course, eventually you have someone like Bill Clinton showing up and then miraculously bringing them out of the territory. I mean, I think that the warning was definitely given by orchestrating something that, as Edward said, was so blatantly in violation of good neighborly relations and indeed international law. So, you know, there was a premeditation behind all of this. Now it just remains to indeed clean up that border, make sure something like that can't happen again, and to keep the stiff upper lip with regard to everything else that's going on with Russia.
No, you mentioned North Korea, and this does really drive home the fact that Russia has become a rogue state. North Korea, by the way, was not just abducting people that were coming to North Korea. There was a time when they were abducting Japanese citizens from Japan, and many of them never returned home. Edward, what do you think the Russians were trying to do here? Was it just testing, probing? Was there maybe this organized crime element?
Probably all of the above. As I said, I think that there's. I do think the timing was significant. I suspect they had a beef with the Estonian Kapo, the Estonian version of the FBI, is extremely effective both in dealing with organized crime and in dealing with Russian spies. And of course, Estonia's got several Russian spies behind bars. They arrested Herman Sim, who was the head of security in their defense ministry, who was one of the most damaging spies in the history of NATO. I wonder if maybe they're going to try and trade Sim or one of the other ones that the Estonians have caught for Mr. Korva. But I think that, in a way, the fact we're talking about it shows is already a victory for Russian psychological warfare, that they've shown that Estonians aren't safe in their own country. They've shown that the West is powerless to do anything about it. And we sit here scratching our heads trying to work out what they're up to. So that's three strikes for Russia.
Agne, your thoughts?
Well, I agree. I agree with what has been said.
And I mean, it's very what Edward has a point that ironically, of course, the Estonian security police have been very successful in abducting or actually arresting different KGB spies or Russian spies within its own ranks. Of course, there's the dual element there, that why were they there to begin with and why weren't they discovered earlier after they could do so much damage? But it is true that there are a good three or so or four of those behind bars currently in Estonia. And that's a thought-provoking, you know, issue that whether it was time for Russia not only to perhaps maybe detain an Estonian diplomat in Moscow, but to go one step further and lure Kofar to the border and thereby then get a little pawn to then exchange in the future. I mean, none of that, I should say, has not really been raised in any of Estonian media. Needless to say, it's a very sensitive thing, and as Edra says, it's not worth speculating about that in public, but those are probably some of the thoughts that come to mind.
I mean, one of the last things I wanted to talk about before we wrap it up is the role of organized crime in all of this, because Kokhver was going to meet a confidential informant. He was investigating a case of organized crime groups smuggling across the border. He was obviously set up, and this raises the whole issue of organized crime as a tool of Russian foreign policy in the Baltics and elsewhere. You can draw a direct line. They've used organized crime groups partially to seize other countries' territories, as is the case with Transnistria in Moldova, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, Georgia, Donbass and Crimea in Ukraine. So you can draw a direct line here, all the way to the Kokhver. Now they're using it to seize people. In terms of the role of Russian organized crime in the Baltic states, is anything being done, anything more being done to push back against this? Because this is not just a criminal justice issue. This is a national security issue.
Well, I think that there's a lot more to be done. And I think particularly the role of Russian organized crime in money laundering through Latvia has attracted very serious high-level attention from the United States and from elsewhere. And I don't feel that Latvia has necessarily learned the lesson of this, that a country their size can't really be a major offshore banking center and expect to run it properly. There's all sorts of questions also surrounding the collapse of Latvia's largest bank, Parex, and the way in which that was bailed out. And there's various other questions about Russian organized crime involving transit across Latvia and indeed across Lithuania. So I think it's kind of like polishing the brass on a ship. No sooner have you done one thing, you have to go and do something on the other side of the ship. It's a never-ending struggle. And the fundamental problem for the Baltic states is they're pretty small. and you're up against a country of 140 million people where organized crime and intelligence and politics and diplomacy and business are all really part of the same thing. And they will deploy whichever of those instruments works best at any one time, often in combinations. And we are not very good in the West, even in strong, well-run Western countries, in dealing with that. And it's particularly difficult for the Baltic states, which are small and only have got quite, in some cases, quite weak institutions with a lot of political baggage attaching to their use, particularly in Lithuania. So I think it's a very serious problem, and we are not yet getting to grips with it.
No, on the day Hochwehr was seized, President Ilves of Estonia tweeted that the Internal Security Service, Estonia's Internal Security Service, Kapo, as Edward said, it investigates both counter-espionage and organized crime. And in this case, it was the same thing. That was from a tweet on September 5, 2014. Velo, is Estonia increasingly looking at organized, or maybe they always have, looked at organized crime as a national security issue in this sense?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I don't think that there is as much of a focus on Russian organized crime sort of penetrating Estonian business or other sectors of society in that way. I mean, we're less of a banking hub, as Edward said, in comparison to Latvia. There is, of course, the transit trade as such, but that's not necessarily controlled by organized crime. I think that the focus is in the Kofor case. I mean, it was probably a way in which to lure Kofor necessarily to the border, get him to think that this was something that was going on and that needed Kapo's attention, and they brought them in. So I think Kapo's own focus on corruption has also been on domestic level issues, and national politicians getting involved in corruption.
Yeah, no, I mean corruption as well as organized crime is a national security issue. Like I like to say, Russia used to threaten Europe with its tanks. Now it threatens it with its banks. Agnia, you have something to add here, I see.
Well, a few points. Well, on your in terms of corruption, also, I mean, it's the tanks, the banks, and then energy. Mm-hmm. Energy supplies have been a vehicle for Russia's corruption, creating corruption in the Baltic states, in Ukraine and beyond. And essentially what you see is, because, these small countries have been in the past so dependent on Russian sources of energy, there's been certain individuals who would often get very, plum contracts, if they had ties to Russia and to Moscow. And then they would be able to use some of these, plum profits to untransparently distribute them, to, make various political payoffs and so on. So, energy has been a huge source of corruption in the region. But I think also going back to your earlier point, I wanted to comment, it's interesting how really organized crime and corruption has been a tool of Russia's foreign policy, particularly in Transnistria, South Ossetia, Abkhazia. Now, those regions, when they started moving, these separatist movements, immediately various organized crime groups moved into the region, both to help assist the separatism track and later running various, arms smuggling, goods smuggling, drug smuggling through those regions. And there's various reports to suggest that, there are a lot of interest groups in Russia that benefit from those smuggling activities in these regions. So, in fact, these separatist regions, like now in eastern Ukraine, are, almost profitable or financially beneficial for certain interest groups in Russia. So I don't think we've quite seen it in the Baltic states, in that regard.
Not yet.
But remember, the Moscow's handpicked president of annexed Crimea, Aktsionov, yes, was a gangster known as the Goblin. So it's something we could expect to see. I'm very glad you raised energy too. This is a subject of an entire podcast, Agnina, and it is one which I would love to have you on when I do it in the future, because there has been progress in this area in terms of the LNG ports opening up in Lithuania and Poland. And once you take this card away from Russia, I mean, you really do I like to say it changes the game. More skeptical people would say it doesn't entirely change it, but it's something certainly we'd like to tackle on this program in the future. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been veteran Kremlin watcher Edward Lucas, director of the Baltic Sea Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and author of the books The New Cold War and Deception, Spies, Lies, and How Russia Dupes the West. Also joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. has been political analyst Agnija Grigas, author of the forthcoming book Rebuilding the Russian Empire. And joining us from Tartu, Estonia has been Vilo Pete, director of the Institute of Government and Politics at the University of Tartu and co-author of the book Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. Thank you all for a fascinating discussion. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.